Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Reddy. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. No Matt Trumpets today, but if you hang around until the end of the show, there will be a pre-recorded segment with Matt as part of our Meet the Panel segment. So if you want to hear me just being a bit nosy and intrusive on Matt Trumpets' life, then hang around till the end of the show. But I'm really, really excited because in the shed today, we have the darling of F1 media, the only person, full stop, that I ever have on a tweet alert. I am absolutely delighted to be joined in the shed by Chris Medland. Hello, Chris.
Hello, mate. How are you doing?
Ah, we're doing good. I'm hoping what you're going to do is revitalize my passion and energy for the upcoming F1 season.
Okay, how do you want me to do that?
With words and dance, please, Chris.
If that's the dance will work on.
Yeah.
I'm not quite there yet myself, to be honest. There's still too much from last year to sort out to before I can get too excited about this year.
And I wonder for people professionally involved in Formula One whether the schedule is actually going to be something that is making people take a deep breath, because the schedule from last season was already crazy, and looking ahead, it's not really going to get any better.
No, and I think the big one was, before we get into the tale of woe of, you know, people that work in F1, but the timing of the final race being so close to Christmas, and then I stayed out in Abu Dhabi for the test, the young driver test they did, and then suddenly it was, you know, I got home on Thursday, Friday was the FIA gala, so you had all the stuff kicking off after that, and suddenly your first day off, I think, was the Sunday, and it was 6 days till Christmas, so you had so much to cram in, it felt so stressful still. And Christmas ends and everyone's like, right, 2022, you ready for the new season? I'm like, no, it feels like I've not stopped yet. So by the end of this month, definitely, everyone will be hyped. But this is the first time that I'm like, yeah, January can be as long as it wants.
Yeah, and which is why we really appreciate you jumping in on a Sunday evening after your Sunday roast to come and speak to us. But whilst we're talking about schedules, I've collected some questions from our patrons. And the first one is related to that, which is from a Monsieur Kilometer. He says, which teams are actively planning or already using multiple shifts of engineers or mechanics to handle the marathon seasons that look to be the norm now? What effect will this have on other resources under the cost cap? And I guess, you know, this affects you guys as well. So how are they handling it?
So I think some teams are doing a bit of rotation, but they don't do it too like high up the chain, really, because they've got to be careful not to
dilute.
It's no offense to the kind of backups that they would bring in, but they've tried to hire the best in certain positions, or at least get people working as well as possible in certain positions. And then you don't want to say, well, on that race, we'll be down a percent or two on our operations. So they basically try and compensate. So I know, talking to Haas recently, Günther Steiner, and it was that if you did more than a certain number of races, you were compensated a bit more to try and make sure that everyone would do them,
right,
essentially, so you could keep your full team working. And I think that is one good way of going about it, in the sense that it's that recognition. A lot of people say they knew what they signed up for, so they shouldn't complain, but what they signed up for was different to what they're now getting. Like, they signed up for 18, 19, 20 races, even the newer people, 20, 21. And you're saying to them, right now you're doing 23, you're doing triple headers, and you know some of the travel schedules are brutal, then it doesn't take long for them to go, actually, this is maybe not what I thought it would be. But if they're good at their jobs, then the teams don't want to lose them. So it's a balancing act, because the teams want to keep them happy. Yeah. So therefore, you want to kind of say, okay, if you're getting burned out or you think this is too much, take a couple of races to work back at the factory or off, basically. But at the same time, then they're hurting themselves in terms of their competitive level. So I think for most, it's a financial incentive to try and say, look, you're still doing all the races, but we are acknowledging that you're having to work harder for them.
I think what might happen naturally is that it becomes a younger person's game as well. And as people just, you know, become parents and then you have spousal and familial pressure, that might start eking out. So, but, you know, perhaps you look at this in a generation's time, if this has become a norm, you then have a group of engineers who, this is what they signed up for, but it's a bit shocking for poor Derek. And is that what you think is happening? They're being told, look, we do need you. You're good. It's tough. But here's some extra money. And they either have to take it or leave it, is the reality.
Yeah, pretty much. And some do. I can't remember who it was I was talking to, actually. I'm going to slightly out someone without outing them, because I genuinely can't remember who it was. But there was a mechanic that said that they were likely to move to European Le Mans because they could get pretty much the same money or close to the same money.
Oh, that's interesting.
But for far less work now, because you had the F1 experience. And it wasn't, I don't think it was like the overall salary was the same. I think, you know, F1 still pays best, but it was that the kind of, compared to the time away from home, the balance, It was that race by race was probably better pay if you're in another series. So they were looking at that. And I think that's where Formula One's getting itself into a bit of trouble, basically. You know, if you can go and do 8 races or 10 races in the year on 60% of the salary of an F1 mechanic, you're going to go and do it pretty soon, because you've got a much better kind of work-life balance out of that, and you still get to do racing. You know, Formula One is not the only race series in the world.
But the problem is, it's like if you are a professional entertainer, people assume because you love it and because it's competitive that you'll take less pay. I spent most of my career in the defence industry, and there's a lot of the engineers are interchangeable between those industries, and they kind of choose between the glamour, if you like, and the cool thing of doing racing, or the pension and sensible money of going into defence and building aeroplanes and missiles and stuff. So, yeah, I guess F1 kind of has them a little bit held hostage in that there's lots of people who would want to do that job.
Yeah, absolutely. And there'll always be a high turnover, I think, in the sense of you'll be very unlikely to run out of people to come and do the job. How well they'll be doing it is another matter, because if you have to bring in basically underqualified or, you know, too soon, in terms of people that might have done Formula 2 for a while, Formula 3, kind of gone through the ranks, maybe done some stuff that was factory-based and learned the ropes in the team. You know, that could be a path that's 7, 8, 9, 10 years until they hit the F1 team. Instead, they're going to be needing them almost immediately, because people are kind of doing a couple of years and going, all right, that's enough for me to hit that box. So I think F1 does have to be careful in that sense. But the flip side is, if it happens to every team, then the level will be the same everywhere. You know, that drop as such won't be noticeable, because everybody will have it. So the smartest teams will probably be the ones that hire all the best people and split the races between them. You know, you can do a third of the season each or something, but that'll take a lot of logistics and a lot of cost. And with a cost cap, that's not realistic at the moment either. So it's a small thing, because for a lot of people, they do still love it. It's just that they keep getting asked to do that bit more for the same money, essentially, and less time at home. And it does reach a breaking point for people.
Yeah.
And I think they say yes each time until eventually they just say no.
Yeah. So, I mean, same money pro rata, like they're not getting an effective pay rise per work, but hopefully they are still being paid for their time. But what about the poor F1 journos? No one's thinking about the likes of you and Uncle Joe. It's going to be rough on you guys as well.
It is travel wise. I'd say actually we're luckier, or some of us are, certainly me as a freelancer, in that a lot of deals are done per race weekend. You know, there's a set amount of work someone wants for a race, or, you know, if it's a monthly deal, then that's more painful, or an annual one, that's more painful. But yeah, if it's race by race, then you are still getting compensated on top. So the more races you do, the more money you earn in that sense. But again, I've had it where there's a balancing act. I've turned down work because it would tie me into definitely doing 23 or something like that. And it, is it worth the sort of pain of not being able to be home at certain times, or just, you know, the stress of even organizing that season, let alone going and doing it. And with COVID added as well, which has been very, very tricky. So
yeah,
it's kind of that balance, and you kind of got to pick it. But yeah, I'd say from a freelance point of view, I've actually been fairly lucky, and I think a few others would be similar, that you can almost pick and choose a little bit more. But for those that are full-time employees of somewhere, for a lot of them, it is tougher, because in the same way that, you know, a mechanic or an engineer has it, you know, they're not getting paid more because there's more races. They're just, you know, they've got an annual salary and that's it. And they're told, well, you're going away from home for even longer. And for some, it's great. Some people, genuinely, it's the best thing ever. You know, it's not everybody. It's just that the ones that it is hurting, it's a bit unfair on if that isn't how they originally signed up and they're not being fairly compensated for it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely rough for the people who are having to face that change. And maybe you end up with, you know, I don't want to say mercenary band, but people who end up going, okay, this is going to be my life. It's 5 years, 10 years, the money's good, it's glamorous, then I'm going to settle down at home and I can buy a house or whatever. What I'd really like to know is why. And I feel like the answer is going to be money. But why are we doing so many races? Because it's so many. And we saw it with football, where is there even an off season in football anymore? Do they take a break at any point? The F1 off season is nearly non-existent. It's triple header after triple header after triple header. Why, and is it good?
So it might surprise you actually to know that it's because of money.
Is it money?
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean, come dang. On. Yeah.
You, at the same time, you do get, you know, more races and more locations means the sport ideally grows. You know, there's more opportunities to be in the public conscience. So there is, you know, there is another angle to it in that sense. But the big thing it comes down to is money. And I'm pretty certain that if you went to Liberty and you went, you can do 25 races and make $200 million, or you can do 15 races and make $300 million, they'll do 15 races. You know, it's definitely, you know, that's the main point. But they've got shareholders to keep happy. There's a lot of people outside that you've got to think of as well.
Yeah.
So there is a balance to be had. You know, we can moan internally, but externally, you know, maybe it's, you'd have a different viewpoint if you're working for Liberty and thinking of those aspects.
So to make my question slightly less dumb, another factor I was thinking was, well, clearly the Middle East is getting more involved in Formula One. They're putting a lot of money in, and you wouldn't bet against them eventually owning Formula One. So then they want their region to have more races. And so you've got Qatar, Saudi, you know, and you've got all these races that are coming into Formula One. So that, does that make five races in the Middle East?
You've got Bahrain, Abu Dhabi. I mean, it depends. Are we counting Baku? But then you've got, yeah, Saudi, okay, and you've got Qatar as well. So you've got four. It's just that Bahrain seems to be on the calendar three times every year at the moment because of COVID.
That's true. And we are starting actually with the Shakir layout for race one. No? Yeah,
so there's only one race in Bahrain this year, and it's the normal layout.
It's the normal layout. Okay,
phew. And then it's straight to Jeddah again.
Okay,
so Jeddah that we've just had, we go back to for the second race.
Phew, because George Russell is quite good at that layout. I mean, I'm neutral. I don't mind which of the Mercedes drivers does better. So obviously, the Middle East they now have it. They'll have their big chunk of the F1 calendar, and we've almost been lucky from a scheduling point of view. A lot of the East Asian tracks have dropped off the calendar during the pandemic, but when the likes of Singapore, China, and fingers crossed Malaysia one day, come on please, go back onto the calendar, you want to keep the heritage tracks in Europe, and then you want to expand into America. I know Liberty are very keen on that. So money aside, there's a lot of tracks just to fit in.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest. I mean, that's a good thing. Like the fact that Liberty are getting to add all these races is because there's so much interest, and they're managing to try and find different ways of doing it. Like the Miami kind of commercial plan is different to the Austin one and that sort of thing. And certainly very different to how much money just goes straight in the coffers from some of the Middle East tracks, or even Singapore was a big, big payer. So there is a balance there, and having that spread and that reach across as much of the globe as possible is definitely something that has to be taken into account and kind of accepted that, you know, it still will help grow the sport if, as long as you're giving a good product on top of that. But and I also think sometimes we give them a bit of a bad rep because, you know, football's exactly the same. You know, FIFA are trying to look at having a World Cup every 2 years rather than every four, because they say,
yes.
And the reason they give is because of how much money they can make from it.
Yeah.
And in one sense, you're like, well, that's understandable because you're a business and you go, well, yeah, we're missing out on all this money.
Well,
so
I only watch football during the World Cup. So they'll get me watching twice as often. So it's sort of hard to turn that down. EJ points out in our live chat, hello live chat, Suzuka as well. We've not had Suzuka for ages. But is it good from a sporting point of view? I guess that takes a big sort of second fiddle. But a lot of F1 fans were experienced, I think a bit of F1 fatigue. Perhaps we're not used to that many races. Maybe we'll adjust to it. Maybe we'll get used to it. Or maybe you'll get driver fans that only tune in for certain Grand Prix instead of all 16. I mean, me, I'm an addict, so I will be watching every single minute of every available session on TV. But some people might end up picking and choosing.
Well, I think, yeah, part of it is you've got to admit, even for fans, like, it's a big sacrifice to give up every other Sunday or more than every other Sunday and say to your family, if you've got family or friends or whatever, no, I can't do anything this Sunday afternoon as a race on. And you're always saying that, essentially. Or you might lose them from qualifying because they say, look, I can't justify every weekend having something in the middle of it that I need to do, so I'll only watch the races. And yeah, you might see that wane slightly, but I think the hope from F1 side is, but then hopefully you still pick up more people who can watch it at that time, and overall the numbers are going to go up, even if you get a drop of, you know, 5% viewing figures on each race, but you've got an extra race or two, that's still hundreds of millions more people watching. So that balance, I think, is one that at the moment they still think they're the right side of, but it will be interesting to see if there's a notable decline in terms of how regularly people are watching, or if each race individually is slightly lower as a viewing figure because there's so many.
Yeah, and then it would just...
Whether they respond.
It would just become like a maths equation then, right? Where's the balance? Fridays is okay because, I mean, for years now, even when I wasn't self-employed, I'd be watching or listening to Friday practice when I was supposed to be working. I can still manage that. But at this point now, I'm having to skip a lot of the qualifyings and just, you know, watch them in bed once all family stuff is done and out of the way. So you're absolutely right. Yeah, we are going to have to make some compromises if it keeps increasing. And right, let's get to some of the patron questions. In fact, before I do, there's a lot of varied patron questions about a variety of different subjects, but I do want to address the elephant in the room. And whilst I don't want to rehash the debate over the outrageously wrong call in Abu Dhabi, I am curious about how you have taken Knowles Gate. And for the non-UK viewers and listeners, you might have noticed a lot of F1 journalists being very vocal about Abu Dhabi at the moment, or defending previous positions about Abu Dhabi. And it's because a TV personality, Nick Knowles in the UK, from a DIY show, basically used his massive Twitter account, you know, compared to F1 journals generally, to just go on a massive rampage, called all of you lot out for not doing your jobs and for not calling for the blood of the FIA. And he went on a sustained Twitter attack for weeks. And I felt actually the stress of that some of the journos felt. Your buddy Nate Saunders there, people are attacking him. Nice, Nate. And he's like, but I did write all these articles. Here's links to all the articles. And that still didn't stop the vitriol that ended up getting put at the F1 media. And I feel like they want you to call for blood. And if you don't, you're an untrustworthy and paid shill. And I don't know if you mind talking about it, but that balance between reporting well, but also just crapping on your own lawn is a difficult one when you're following, you know, a governing body, one governing body, and that's all your job is following around that organisation.
It's the way you do it as well. Well, first with the Nick Knowles thing, he came out and he had a real go at originally it was at Sky, essentially, or anyone employed by F1. And so someone like Will Buxton got tagged in it. And I'm thinking, surely anyone with half a brain goes, but he is employed by Formula One. So it's always going to be limited what he can say. And like, I don't mind them saying, okay, we can't take what you say and therefore assume that that's all, like the whole picture. But you can't have a go at him for not giving you, if that makes sense, because of what his role is. Sky, more so, you can. But Nick Knowles actually never tagged in any of the, like, the written media as such. I think maybe one or two, but not many. It just seemed to be that followers would then go, yeah, they're all rubbish. Yeah. I got tagged in further down his first rant by some fan, and he then replied, Nick Knowles, in general to the whole thing, but it meant I was just added as a tag to this list of journos. I'm like, he didn't call me out, but someone else has made it look like he did.
Yeah.
And then later, Luke Smith from Autosport made a very good point, because somebody replied to a Nick Knowles tweet saying, oh, you know, where was the reporting of what the drivers had to say afterwards. Like, you never saw any of these quotes and like screenshots of, or like, you know, their own typings of Ricciardo saying that it was pretty effed up and this sort of thing. And Luke was like, totally incorrect. First story we ran on the Sunday night after the race, here's a link to it. And Nick Knowles replied being like, oh, I need to make clear that I think the magazines and the online websites and stuff have done a brilliant job. They're really doing their job. It's the TV personalities that I'm after. But that didn't matter. Like, you still were getting caught up in it. So fans just kind of just, they use one paintbrush and go, F1 media is everybody. Therefore, you're all in for hate. And yeah, I had it. I did a comment piece about a week ago. Basically because I'd spoken to a few teams at the start of last week and found they'd had nothing direct yet from the FIA, and they were starting to get a bit like, okay, we should know what's happening and when. They really need to be saying and explaining it. And I totally agreed. I was like, they weren't in a position to sit there quietly and go, well, we'll just do our job quietly and then we'll tell everyone the outcome.
Yeah.
There's so much riding on it. They need to explain to people what's going on and how they're going to do it, even if there's no substance. They just had to open that line of communication. And when I ran that piece, one of the replies was, you know, why did it take Nick Knowles? You know, suddenly Nick Knowles starts having a go at you, yeah, and you finally speak up. And I was like, incorrect, and listed, same like Nate did, listed all the articles that had covered it before. And for most people, they replied to that and like, yeah, you know, don't worry about it. Like, people shouldn't be coming after you. But the same person still were like, nope, definitely correct. And I'm like, I've just given you the proof. So sometimes a lot of it has been argument for argument's sake with some, I've noticed. But the big thing was, From my point of view, you kind of made the points originally. Like, on the Sunday night when the race happened, it happened very quickly. You didn't know the appeal process, how it was going to go down. It was taking a little while to report on what was happening in terms of at the track in race control when Merck appealed and had the hearings.
Yeah.
But then once you got the result of that, it was 1 a.m. and you start looking through the regs to try and work out, you know, was this definitely very wrong, or was it just a dodgy interpretation,
sorry,
or what?
Sorry, you're talking. Sorry.
It turns out it was. But at that point, you're like, you start to doubt yourself that early in the morning. But B, you're going, okay, so I think the way I read the rules, that shouldn't have happened. But the way the stewards have just said it is that this means, you know, what was it? All doesn't mean any, or any doesn't mean all, that sort of thing. And you're just like, semantics are now coming into play that clearly aren't what it references. But then everyone's gone home, so you can't go and call anyone else out on it. You can only say what you've said. Then we had all the appeals process, so you followed that. And once that then was ended by Mercedes, that was when it was kind of clear where we were at in the whole situation, and you could say, no, this is not right. But then it was a week before Christmas, so you've done a couple of follow-up articles saying this isn't right, they need to get this sorted. You've done all the reaction from the different teams and drivers. And then there's nobody else to speak to. Like, they've all gone off for Christmas holidays, and that's everyone, including the FIA, who, let's be honest, it's essentially one man or race control's decision that is the problem. But then it's the FIA itself that's going to mark its own homework, which is also a problem. But those people that have to do that, everyone else working in the FIA, understandably, after what was such an intense year of racing in COVID, had time off booked. You know, they were going, it's for some people, you know, they're going to see parents the first time in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Like, the head of comms from F1's point of view was trying to get himself to South Africa to see his parents the first time in 2 years. And it looked like he wasn't going to be able to because of Omicron. And I genuinely felt sorry for the guy, like, massively. But then people are having to go at us for not then chasing, like, or hounding them. It's like, well, I've asked, and they've said that there's nothing we can tell you right now. We've got to wait for this detailed analysis to start happening. So you're like, okay, but you still give your opinion. But yeah, I got the feeling that a lot of fans on social media want us basically outside the doors, like hammering them down. And I don't mind this whole thing of when they say crappy on the lawn, not at all. Like, if they've done wrong, like if the FIA do wrong, same if F1 itself does wrong, you call it out, absolutely. At the same time, though, when I think they do something right, I'll say I think they've done something right. And the problem I had was there's a way to go about it. Like, if I'm unhappy with someone, this is a quite a morbid way of putting it, but I was like, basically, if you're about to miss a train because it's pulling out of the station and you want it to be on it, and it's pulled out a bit early, so you're in the right, you got there on time. You don't like go and stand on the track and put your hand up and be like, you got to stop for me because I'm coming on.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to lose that battle. So you have to basically think, right, how do I actually make my point here? You know, what are the lines of communication that are open? Yeah. What are the channels I can go down? Same thing with the FIA. Like, it was, you've got to keep asking the questions. We've got to ask for as much insight as possible, but there's, you can't just go kicking and screaming because it'll get nowhere. And there, I rarely say this, but we are professionals, so we have to maintain a professionalism for the way we go about this to try and find out what really went on.
You can't start name calling and kicking off
just sit there being like, However some of the fans wanted it done, you can't go crazy and throw an explosive in there and say, like, tell us everything. Like, it's just not the way that it works. You've got to be more professional about it. So that's the way I feel that a lot of people were trying to work, and they then got their own backs up because they got called out for essentially trying to do their jobs in like just the methodical way.
So where are we? Where are we now? Would be my question, because obviously we got to wait for Sue Gray's report. We've got to wait for the FIA report now, and it's a new president as well, which is really interesting. And from what I've heard from him, if you were hoping for a new broom and a completely new way of doing things, I think you might be disappointed. This gentleman seems very much in line with old FIA. He seems very much like John Todt, and he seems an authority figure that is a continuation vote for me, from what I'm seeing. So if I'm wrong, I'd love to hear about it, because he had made some pledges about grassroots motorsport as well, which I really hope he can follow through on. So he's now coming to the job, and the first thing he's got to do is probably deal with the most controversial referee call in F1 history since 94 at least. And so I guess the question is, how do you see that going down? Can Michael Massey survive in his role as well?
In terms of how I see it going down, I do feel sorry for Ben Saliem, because he gets the job, he's given the keys at the end of that
hospital
week.
Hospital pass, isn't it?
Yeah, all Todd Studd is gone. We should analyse this, do a detailed analysis. Great, that's me with a great recommendation. Right, I'm out, see you later. There's someone else will oversee all that now and deal with the fallout. And look, Todd didn't make that call, or as far as we know, we'll find out if he had any influence in terms of what he wanted the way racing to be handled over this season, or at any stage, if there's anything that anyone had said that might have all come together for this to have happened. But Todd, I think he was probably a bit hurt that what should have been his grand departure was completely overshadowed by what had gone on in Abu Dhabi. But he did get to walk away from it, and now it is Ben Saliem's problem, and it's a big problem. So I feel for him a bit, because he's also then got to he was focusing on campaigning and lobbying and winning the election. As soon as it's done, and again straight into Christmas and New Year when a lot of people are off, so he didn't have long to then just even get used to where he's going in any of the FIA buildings, like as the president, let alone sort this problem out. So I can understand the delay. I wouldn't say he's the continuation. I think Graham Stoker would have been a continuation because he had worked with Todd and he was looking to. I did an interview with Stoker before the election, and he said that he didn't buy into the approach that everything needs changing. He's like, things need improving on, but there's a lot of foundations that have been laid that are good. And I think Ben Saliem hopefully won't change everything, because it essentially over the 4-year term, if you want to change everything within a corporation that big, you're just not going to get through it all. So nothing actually will improve at all. It'll all get worse before it gets better. So I think there will be some stuff that stays the same, but I think there'll be some other bits that are different. He clearly wants to play on the fact that he used to be a driver, and says, that's my connection to the drivers themselves.
Rally?
That comes up in every answer.
Rally?
Yes, rally driver, yeah. But that came up in most answers he gave in the couple of press conferences he's done. And I think it was a deflection technique, because he's like, well, right now I'm not in a position to really say much more. So I just need to say that I understand the driver's point of view and their frustrations, and I will talk to them. But that only will go so far in that role now. Like he's going to have to be very smart politically. He's going to have to be very strong. And to be honest, when I ask about Michael Massey, I think, dare I say, it's an easy win for Ben Saliem, but one of them will be to not have Massey in that role coming back.
Yeah.
At the very least, a complete restructuring where it's not full control to Massey, because even if it turns out, because we don't know yet, how it all came together, what was said by who in terms of the way they wanted the race to be handled or anything like that. Even if Massey was under pressure from elsewhere, this is just speculation. This isn't I've heard this.
I made the same speculation, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. If he's had pressure from elsewhere and then he's gone down that route and then there's this backlash and no one's had his back so far, basically, there's going to be no confidence in him from so many teams now. He's lost the respect of the teams that I don't think it's going to be possible for him to have full control in race control and not have every decision questioned. Even if he makes every decision perfectly from now on for the rest of his life, they're not going to trust him as much.
And when a lot of those calls are safety calls, that is critical. Even if, and I can't quite say, even if he's not to blame at all, there's a critical safety call. If that's being second guessed, that is a danger. But for the new president, he can always say that is something that was under a previous administration. Had it still been Todd, and he made a, he can't then damn himself effectively, whereas the new president can make changes and make conclusions.
Yeah, that's true. It kind of gives him the freedom to do it because he wasn't there. But at the same time, yeah, you could find that he turns around and goes, look, this what didn't happen under me. I'm going to restructure things. But, you know, these are people that weren't working for me originally. So I'm going to give them a chance under me type thing. I think that'd be a brave call to make. But it's a bit, you know, it's a bit harsh almost to until the full facts are established. And again, we've got to wait a long time for that now, the way the FIA has set out the timeline. It's essentially the final findings or any changes are going to be on the Friday of the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend, which is only too late really to really influence major change, isn't it? So it's, say Marcy doesn't lose his job, then he's not going to lose it on the Friday of the race weekend if they either don't have a replacement lined up or they didn't know it's coming. So we'll either know much earlier or he will continue. But if he's done nothing wrong, then, or there are circumstances that, I say nothing wrong as in, you know, he was following certain orders or whatever, if there's any sort of explanation that can make sense for how it ended up this way, that absolves him of so much of the blame, then it'd be really unfair to be screaming for his head and say he has to go when actually it might not be totally his fault. But I think just the circumstances that have been created, whether it was by him or by anybody else, means that it's an untenable position for him. And, you know, if the FIA need to, then they should kind of say to him, look, you can run another category of racing. Like, we're going to move you on to something else, but we need to completely shake up F1 because there's just no faith in it anymore. Even from the teams, talking to the teams, they are, you know, they're pretty unhappy about the fact that the way they're now going racing, there's this doubt, there's this, that this is what all the focus is on.
Yeah.
That there's this negative energy around F1, and that's all come from the FIA, not from any of the teams themselves.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you think this is from the team bosses as well? Obviously, there wasn't just Abu Dhabi in 2021. Brazil also attracted a lot of attention, just judging the way that drivers are allowed to drive and defend, and perhaps hearing that team principal to Massey radio as well, and just seeing like how forthright and convincing and hypnotic Christian Horner can be mid-race. Like, he would make an excellent cult leader, and I'm not sure I wouldn't join the cult, but he was under a lot of pressure. When you say it's team bosses, is it a lot of team bosses that were looking at that situation going, something not quite right here, we don't know how to go racing?
Yeah, I think most team members looking at it were kind of like, well, if that can be, like, then further down the line, what else could change? Or, you know, there's just so many inconsistencies all year. And I agree with you, a lot of it wasn't helped by the audio that we heard from team principals, because for a lot of them as well, that wasn't their job. Like, they, I think McLaren explained it quite well. They have one person within the team who liaises, I think their sporting director liaises with Massey, but, you know, Zach Brown or Andrea Seidel doesn't jump on the radio and scream and shout at him, because they're overseeing so much more, and they probably are a bit more passionate and caught up in it, but they're not dealing with the specifics of maybe that exact regulation at that time. They don't have it in front of them or whatever, like a sporting director might need to have. So I think that definitely did need limiting. And Ross Brawn came out, I think, and said, look, we're going to limit that. The bit that we heard from him after Abu Dhabi, that I think he spoke to Automotor and Sport in Germany and said, look, we're going to stop that happening. And Zak Brown said he's really pleased to hear that because he thinks that's right. And I'm the same. It's great for TV. It was great, like, insight when they opened up the FIA channel. But at the same time, it kind of glorified talking back to the ref. And I'm a big sports fan on all sports. Mm. And it's one of the things I really dislike about the lack of control a referee has in football is the way that players are allowed to speak to them, managers can rant at them.
And it goes all the way down. Yeah, it goes all the way down.
It does, yeah, absolutely. Yep. I mean, yeah, kids are doing it. Like, I was genuinely yesterday. I went to watch some rugby, some fairly local rugby here in London, and it was great. And the respect for the ref was excellent. But on the way there, getting off the train, there was just a Saturday afternoon game on the park going on, and you could hear the effing and blinding at the referee for decisions. And it's just a reaction, you know. He blows up and gives a free kick, and people swear at him, and then they just carry on like that's normal. That shouldn't, in my view, I was always like, that's terrible, that shouldn't be allowed. But in F1, suddenly we started to kind of glamorize it. And I think that was a dangerous thing. So as much as it might make the radio comms less entertaining, I think it's the right thing from a sporting thing.
Yeah, but it looked good on the Netflix series, which you were on, Mr. Medland. It's you. It's all to make you and your talking head happy.
I do feel sorry for Netflix. Like, the guys that make that, they said the abuse they got, like, obviously... In some senses, it's great for them because of the drama around it. But in others, they're like, well, A, we don't have access to race control. So, you know, it's not like we have the inside story on this. But B, the way that people then say it's because of them.
Yeah, they're controlling it apparently now. Netflix are in control.
And they're also, they've just announced it that they are doing a documentary on tennis. So they're in Melbourne, the same company that do the F1.
Oh, no!
So you've got the Djokovic thing going on. They're like, of course, that's all our fault too. So they're kind of, as much as it is good content for them, they have nothing to do with it. And if they didn't exist, we'd definitely still have this. Like you said, 94. Yeah. I mean, 94 would have been the exact same scenario if we had social media and Netflix. And, you know, if that happened today, even if we ruled racing the way we should, because it was only 3 years later that Schumacher got disqualified from the whole season for what he did to Villeneuve. Yeah. Like that wasn't that much of a different time between those two instances. So it's just the way that they were kind of covered and viewed.
Okay. Let me get your opinion on this, because, you know, we were talking about things filtering down, and we've started to see in sim racing. So we do a lot of sim racing in Missed Apex, and we had our 12-hour enduro yesterday. We raised, I think we're going to tick over to £5,000 for Macmillan Cancer Support. So thank you so much to everyone who donated and gave their time. Unfortunately, Brad Philpott's team won, which makes it look like a fix. But honestly, we tried everything. We even gave them a 16-year-old driver, but it turned out he was like an MX5 champion. But in sim racing, we are seeing in the public lobbies people doing a Verstappen. I'm not trying to be anti-Verstappen here, but doing that kind of move very aggressively on the outside, all the way off, you know, the Brazil-type move. And that filters down. And before our event, we had to be very clear. In our event, you need to leave racing room on the outside. If you drive in such a way that your opponent has to leave the track when he's alongside you, you're going to be penalised. So this isn't anti-Verstappen, but going forward, if I'm a team principal, driver coach now, I will be saying to my drivers, you had better damn well drive like Verstappen does. You had better not turn. If someone's overtaking you on the outside, you go all the way to the edge of the track and beyond. You have to do that now, because that is modern F1. What's your take on that? Firstly, am I being weird and paranoid? But should we do something about it?
So I think something needed to be done about it. I think the problem is, like, it's not clear that is okay, because it was in Brazil, but then it wasn't in Jeddah, which is why that was when I had sympathy for Verstappen.
I felt
it was completely unfair what happened, or completely wrong that he was allowed to do it in Brazil. But once that happened, for him to then do the same two races later and be told, no, you can't do that now.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, unless you've made that abundantly clear to everybody, then, which perhaps behind closed doors they did, but, and most of the drivers seem to say prior to that event happening, it's still not clear what we can and can't do. Then I've got sympathy for the driver just being consistent themselves and being penalised differently. And then you get something like Abu Dhabi, where I will defend Verstappen for the first lap. What more is he meant to do when he throws it down the inside at turn, was it six? Gets the car stopped. Now, I'm still amazed that Lewis left the door open, but I assume it was because of the fear of contact. But the door was open. Max made the corner, made a clean overtake, essentially. Lewis took the runoff, completely fine, too, to avoid contact in the sense of, you know, he either, if there'd been a wall there, he'd have had to back out much earlier, or the two of them would have ended up in the wall together, or Lewis would have ended up in the wall. I get those points. So take the runoff because it's there. But Max actually made that move stick cleanly. And then for the stewards not to give him that place back, I also was like, why is that? Like, what more is he meant to do? Is he meant to kind of send them a note to say, I'm going to pass him on the inside here, I'm going to use this amount of braking force, I'm going to be at this angle? Like, you've got to let them, that's the point where I'm like, let them race. I just felt they got it wrong so many times last year. And that is something, again, that enough team bosses have said, is that they need a complete rewrite of certain rules to make it clear where we start from next year, because otherwise, at the first race, nobody will still know what will count as a legal move and an illegal.
All right, well, look, let's fix it. Brilliant. Let's take 5 minutes to fix it. And by the way, Weitzer in our live chat just says, I love how Chris is mentioning the humans that are being pulled into everything. I think it was very important to have the conversation and your view on the media and how you guys were affected.
Just on that, actually, there was something you said about some of the questions that came in, and someone said, you know, did anyone have any pressure from F1 or the FIA or anything like that about the way you should... I don't know if I've jumped ahead, but here...
No. Let me read the question. I just skipped it for time, but it was Jack, and he said, Jack Reeves said, he may or may not be able to answer this on record, and I don't want you, like, getting sacked for anything, but on the F1 Nation podcast, which is produced by F1, they didn't mention the Abu Dhabi controversy at all post-race, presumably due to pressure from F1. So his question was, Have you had any pressure not to say anything from F1 like that? And if so, has that changed in recent years? And on a personal note, I'd like to say, what is the F1 gift basket like? Because I hope to get it one day, and then I will totally just say whatever they want.
I'll tell you what, more through my better half, Jess, who also works in F1 and is friends with one of the PRs at Sky.
Talk about power couple.
We got a Christmas hamper from Sky.
Did
before
you?
Abu Dhabi. That was really nice.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is, I've been a pain in their backside for most of the year about press conferences and televising things. And I don't think they're a huge fan of mine, to be honest, but not a single thing from anybody anywhere. Nothing from F1, nothing from the FIA. Even when I've been critical of both and then I've contacted either side to ask for an update or what's going on, they've been courteous with their reply. They might not have been particularly helpful, but they haven't been like, well, we're not helping you because you said this or that. None of that. Same from the teams. Like there's been no team saying you need to be doing this more, you need to be doing that more. There's been nothing from Red Bull saying, you know, why are you criticizing stuff? You know, we won the title fair and square or whatever. I think they appreciate that it's, you know, doesn't involve them really. Yeah. It wasn't their fault.
Nope.
The focus is on the way it's governed. So no, absolutely nothing. I'm more than happy to say it on record. And to be honest, I think I would be amazed if anybody who doesn't directly work for F1 or the FIA, I'd be amazed if any of them have had someone in their ear saying, you know, don't say this, do say that, because it would get out. It would absolutely get out. This is such a big deal.
That's true. Yeah.
You couldn't get away with it. And the second it did, the second one journalist went, Formula One said to me, don't put pressure on us about this. Boom. They're in huge credibility trouble. So I've actually got a meeting with someone from F1 this week. It was meant to be last week. Just for a general chat that we were going to have in one of the earlier races before the end of the season about just the way the media works with F1. And there's questions I'd like to ask them about certain things, but have had absolutely nothing. And they quite easily could just drop your WhatsApp and go, you know, turn the heat down a bit, or, you know.
Hey, Medders, we're trying our best. Just give us a week, man. Give us a week.
No, dare I say, to be fair to them, as in the way they've handled us as media, not a thing. They've just, okay. I think they appreciate it. These are not the people that make the calls anyway. But I think they know that we have to. Like, when we do criticise them, we have to, if they've done wrong. As much as fans will say we haven't done that enough.
And but actually, Weitzer's larger point that he was making there before we went down that path was that whatever your viewpoint of what happened in 2021, because you were talking about the human element, we should remember that Massey is also a human being, and he must be at home at the moment. He must be a wreck sat at home over what is, you know, it's a sport and... I'm sure we're not calling him evil, and most people are just going, this is a terrible call. It's been misjudged. He must be at home. It must not have been a good Christmas in the Massey household.
No, not at all. And I maintain, and I put this in print at the time as well, I maintain he wasn't trying to help Verstappen win the championship. He wasn't being biased towards any driver.
Oh, like, yes, I agree.
Purposefully.
Yeah.
He was trying to create the most exciting finish possible. He was trying to get them racing each other for the title. He thought, I guess, that what he was doing was a good thing, that he was like, it doesn't deserve to end this way. We should see them fight for the championship on track. We should have a green flag finish. And what he unfortunately then did, you know, or wrongly did, was create a situation where really only one driver was going to win.
Yeah.
Because of the way it all panned out. And it did unfairly influence the race. But I completely disagree with the view. I can't speak for him because I haven't spoken to him, so I don't know. But I completely disagree with the view that he was trying to get Verstappen to win the championship. I don't believe that's true at all. I think he was just trying to make it the most exciting finish he could.
So in our fixing of Formula One that we're going to do now, I guess that's number one on the list, is the referee, which is what race control essentially is, just managing, you know, the game. The referee checks the studs on the players, brings play back, has access to VAR. What's it called in football? The camera system.
It's VAR. Yeah.
It's VAR. He's got access to that, which is the equivalent of referring it to the steward, but we need to, I guess, remove any broadcast pressure from race control, because I'm convinced there was broadcast pressure on race control.
Yeah, I would be. There's obviously broadcast influence, isn't there? Because they have the channels, they put them out there. They have they're tapped into the FIA, and they must discuss it. I'd be amazed if they don't discuss with the FIA what they can and can't broadcast from their conversations with teams.
Yeah, but that's bad. You haven't got a football referee hasn't got you know, the F1 and Sky in his head telling him what looks good on telly.
Well, so I think with, and this sounds weird, but I think with cricket and their decision review system, I think it is actually tied in to the broadcaster, because obviously those pictures instantly go out. Yeah. And I think it's actually the broadcaster that calls them up. They have someone who sits with the broadcaster to access all these shots. So I guess in a sense they are tied in. But yeah, I mean, it just needs to remain completely impartial if that's going to be the case. I mean, it'll be more time because Formula One produces a world feed that then goes out to all the different broadcasters. So, yeah, you know, it's not like Sky produce their own trackside shots and things. It's all comes from one central Formula One controlled broadcast center. So from that point of view, if it's a Formula One and FIA tie up, then it just needs to be, you're right, that there shouldn't be any commercial influence going on. There shouldn't be the F1 going to the FIA and saying, look, you know, this is a bad look for us to finish a season like this. You need to change it. The FIA need to have complete freedom to handle it the best way they think. And what really surprises me, okay, the race hadn't been a classic, but we'd had some moments of excitement and drama.
Yeah.
But in 2012, we had all that, and it was still massively dramatic, and it was like Vettel looked like he was going to win the title, but Alonso looked like he might at certain times, and it was raining in Brazil, and then we had the big shunt for DiResta, and it ended under safety car, and that was it. They didn't red flag that. They didn't think, wow, we need to finish this in racing style because it's been such an epic season. They rolled over the line behind a safety car and nobody had a go because it was what the rules said to do.
It's so normal to finish under a safety car.
Yeah.
But I think the Americans, and I don't want to be a countryist, but a lot of North Americans have said to me, oh no, but it would have been a disaster if it finished under the safety car. And I'm astounded. I'm like, no, finishing under the safety car is such a completely normal thing to happen. Almost dramatic in its own right, I guess.
Yeah, I think. But then if I defend them, I guess what they're probably saying by disaster in that compared to finishing it with a last lap shootout, yes. You know, and nobody going into it would have wanted it to finish that way. Like everybody would have been like, oh, it's a bit deflating that it finishes in that style. But that, I think that would have been a feeling for like an hour or two. Like that excitement that you had thinking it might restart or watching the race itself, like would have been drained out of you to watch it just roll behind the safety car to finish. But then it would have been actually, you know, that's not the moment that's decided this championship. It's been all of these over this season. Instead, we did get something that you could turn around and point to, a moment that decided the championship that had nothing to do with the driver, which is a real shame. But yeah, I think there's a lot will need to be reviewed that's not just about the racing rules or the way race control works in terms of applying regulations. You're right. It's about the way the whole kind of sphere at an F1 circuit kind of fits together and who works with who and who can influence who. And I don't think it's a problem that F1 and the broadcaster gets to speak to race control if it's to get more access for fans to understand stuff. It might actually mean more transparency, but I would remove the team principals being able to scream and shout because that's just not fair.
Okay, so I'm going to play the role of the new FIA president. And how is he addressed in normal greetings? Ben Sulayem?
Mohammed Ben Sulayem, yeah.
Okay, Mohammed Ben Sulayem, yeah.
I have not actually met him in person yet.
Okay, so you're not Bezies. He's not like, hey, call me Mo. There's none of that
no,
yet.
No, not
we're
yet.
Not there. Okay.
No. So we'll get there, though.
But he does call you up and he says, you know, sorry, overdue, Chris. Should have spoken to you earlier. We want to get this sorted before the start of the season. What are our instructions to the drivers on the Verstappen-type moves, particularly like Monza, you know, leaving the foot in, ending up on top of the car, pushing wide in Brazil, and you can point to Hamilton doing these same kind of moves against Rosberg. You can also point to Leclerc a little bit. The Leclerc and Hamilton ones, not quite to the same extent. Verstappen has taken it to another level, I think. Where do we stand on that, Mr. Medland? We'll go on you. Either everyone's going to do that, or we bring it all back and ask for more racing room. What's your recommendation, sir?
Mine is that we ask for more racing room. It's that we are, you know, maybe if you have to make it very, very simple, you go any time that one driver has to leave the track to avoid contact with another driver, we will investigate. That doesn't mean you're going to penalise, but it means that they're going to have a proper look at it and say, was that due to the car on the inside or the car that forced the other driver off, forcing that situation? Or was it because the one on the outside, because this does happen sometimes, was just chancing their arm. They weren't really going to make the corner themselves and they made it look like they got forced off when really it wasn't going to happen. And that does still happen too. So to say to them, look, you know, we're going to look at it and we're going to look at it at all of them. And I think one thing that they should double down on, though, it's something that some of the team bosses wanted reviewed to make more lenient, but I think they need to stick with the penalty point system for these driving infringements, because you're essentially saying that if we do find you guilty of this, if we do feel that you would have caused an accident if the other person hadn't taken evasive action, which is something that Lewis always complained about, the amount of times he got out of Max's way, then you are penalising them with points that will add up. You can't just keep doing it. You have to change your ways. Now, to be fair to Max, most of the time he wasn't penalised, so he didn't need to change his ways. But if they were penalising more consistently or handling it more consistently, that lesson would have needed to get through to either him or any other driver that kept getting penalised for it, because the penalty points would rack up pretty quick.
Yeah, I've not blamed really Verstappen for making those moves. In fact, I've been more critical of Hamilton. Not, and it's hard to say this, it's kind of stupid to say, but like, let yourself get hit a couple of times by that move. Force the stewards to make a decision. I said the same thing about Rosberg as well. It's like, hold your ground, let him hit you, and then see what the stewards say.
So there is a way of doing that, you're right, that is, I think, would help. But there's also a point where you kind of go, well, you're in a position where you're the driver gets to choose if there's contact or not. You're still in racing cars at 100 miles an hour or something.
Yeah, it's kind of
you don't know how it's going to end out. And I remember Felipe Massa at one stage with Lewis Hamilton, what would it have been, about 2011, maybe 2012, before Lewis left. They were like magnets to each other.
Yeah.
But the amount of times you saw Massa allow an accident to happen, like he'd got the high ground. He knew he wasn't in the wrong. So he'd be like, so we're crashing. And I just felt that was, for someone as well who'd had like a serious injury from something that was so freak, I was like, in these cars, surely you can't be doing that. I mean, it costs a hell of a lot of money anyway to repair them, but like, there is a danger factor here. So I prefer to see a driver actually getting out the way. I think it just does need harsher stewarding to say, just because he's jumped out the way doesn't mean it wasn't a dangerous move or an illegal move. Well, it's like in football, you quite often get it.
Yeah, jumping over the two-footed tackle is still a dangerous two-footed tackle.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you don't stand there and let your leg get broken. You jump out the way. But then because you didn't end up on the floor in pain, they're like, well, it's not a foul. It's like, well, no, it absolutely is.
You know, I was taught as a kid, I had a coach who just kept saying to me, he's like, stop staying on your feet. You've got to go down. You've got to go down to get the foul. Jose in our chat says, the thing is, if you let yourself be hit, you get a crash. The other car gets a meaningless 10-second penalty and goes on to win the race. And it's not as simple as us here saying, oh, well, yeah, you know, defend the outside car more. We can point to two examples in the season where you said the outside car hangs on in there where they shouldn't. One for Hamilton, probably Imola. He probably didn't quite have enough to be where he is, and they did end up having contact. And then Verstappen at Monza in the chicane. That was done. But then he's like, oh no, I was forced off. So yeah, if we go too far, oh, I'm glad it's not me that's having to make the decisions, but clearly something was not right this season.
Yeah, and we had so many occasions this year where the top two, the two biggest names arguably in the sport that right now to the best talents were going wheel to wheel, properly fighting for a race win. Like, that's what made it such a great season. This wasn't one of those years where one car was dominant at one sort of track and one was dominant at another and they kind of just picked up the wins here and there. That happened a bit towards the end of the year at times, but so many races, it was the two of them together on track. So there were big decisions that did need making. it was just the inconsistency was so frustrating, and then also made it harder for them to know what they could do. And when you're in such a tight title fight, you need consistency, because the tiniest margin is going to make a difference. And it generally did. Like, if we look at, you know, to go into the final race level on points, like, there was definitely moments earlier in the season where each of them could have done something differently that could have changed that outcome. So it wasn't, in that sense, it wasn't all on Abu Dhabi. And that is one thing we forget. But there were other moments that happened in the season where, because things maybe weren't clear to the drivers, or because they were made slightly tentative because they thought they might get a penalty for something, or maybe overly aggressive because they thought they wouldn't, whatever it was, the lack of consistency didn't help throughout the year. And that's one of the big frustrations. But in another way, we can also defend Massi there, because his job isn't to give out the penalties. His is just to tell the stewards to have a look at it. I felt he should have in Brazil. But other than that, most of the time, you've actually got to turn around and say, well, it's the stewards that have made the wrong decision. It's not Massi. He's the one who's just said to them, I think you should look at this.
All right. All right. Do you know what? The whole thing, it's like, I thought I was over it, and then we start talking, and now I just start getting all het up. But it does show how much, you know, we love the sport, and I can tell that you are a genuine 100% a super fan of Formula One. So that makes me super doubly jealous of your job and your world. So let's just do some quick fire questions to finish off from our patrons, if that's okay from you. Let's see. John M says, Audi Porsche. How real is it?
Very real, but has been a number of times before, speaking to people that have worked at Porsche specifically. And the problem is, it's at the whim of some very senior execs. And if the timing's right, then they'll be pushing ahead with it. But then the split second the timing's not right and they need to think of their jobs, they'll just say, nope. You know, they're big enough companies to do that. They can go quite a long way down the line and spend quite a lot of money into setting up or researching it and evaluating it. And if it's going to look bad at the wrong time or something, then in a split second, they can change their minds.
And I wonder if this has been going on at Renault to some extent. I've certainly speculated heavily that it is, that you are on the whim of a CEO, whoever's in that position. And for a lot of teams, they will be sold. Like, it looks like Cyril Abiteboul probably sold them on this plan. We are going to go back. This is going to be glorious for you. And then they ended up palming it off on a sub-brand. And I'd love to have been in the room in the meetings that decided that. So is there someone telling Audi and Porsche, no, this is glory, or is this Audi and Porsche saying, let's just be part of the circus? Can they be realistic and still sell the F1 dream?
Yeah, I think it's more Audi and Porsche, and they'll have looked at it from the outside. You know, you look at Mercedes and the model they've created. You know, that was obviously an existing F1 team, and it's just part owned and part funded by Mercedes as the actual brand, by Daimler, but not solely. But it's known as the Mercedes team. It gets them great publicity, coverage, PR. It's not quite win on Sunday, sell on Monday, but it does heighten like your reputation if you've got a dominant Formula One team that you must make good quality road cars. And that will be something that Audi and Porsche want a slice of. And it's become more realistic now because A, the budget cap means you don't need to spend stupid money where it's not actually going to give you a return anymore. You can actually run it at a profit if you run it properly. But B, it also means with the reset in certain regs, the way the engine regs are changing, because that was obviously a huge differentiator in 2014, having a new set of engine regs that are attractive is a starting point where you can be competitive from. Whereas, you know, if it had been any of the last 6, 7, 8 years, if either Porsche or Audi wanted to come in, look at what happened to Honda. Honda's a huge brand, and it took so long for them to finally get it right. It was so damaging to them for so long. So that, you know, for a lot of people, they couldn't do it before now.
Oh, we've got lots of questions here. Okay, Mia says, what about Otmar? Is he finished? Look, let's ask the real question. Mr. Medland, when are they announcing Otmar Schaffnauer for Alpine team principal?
So I don't mind being wrong sometimes, honestly. And I will sit here now and say, I'm not certain that's going to happen.
Ooh,
I'm not saying it won't. I'm not saying it won't. I don't know it's certainly going to happen. What I know is that Otmar wanted out of Aston Martin, went talking to people, went looking for a way out or somewhere to go. And once he then essentially got a good exit package, I guess, from Aston Martin, he realized his time was up there because of the structure that's around him. He wasn't being given the power he wanted. He'd been at that team for so long. Whitmarsh had come in above him. They're obviously lining someone up because the fact that Mike Crack's come in so quickly. Yes, I knew you were going to laugh. Everybody is going to laugh.
Why isn't he going by Michael? Come on, why isn't it Michael Crack? Come on.
That was one of the funniest things I saw on Twitter. I think it's Tommy Bellingham, who does WTF1 stuff, who took the screenshot of Toto from Abu Dhabi. And he said, Michael Crack, when he told his friends that he wanted to be known as Mike. And it just says, no, Michael, that's so not right. No, no, no. And it was, yeah, I thought that was genius.
Okay, sorry. Okay, that's the last time I'm going to be puerile about that, I promise.
I mean, yeah, we'll all get past it quickly. But he's very good at his job. He could well be, they're looking for like an Andreas Seidel thing. I think Aston look very much at what McLaren have done. You know, it's another reason they hired Whitmarsh is like the group setup and the way that McLaren's worked. And they want to emulate that in certain ways. And some of the paths they've taken seem to be very, very similar. But Otmar, I think, just wanted out, knew his time was up, was looking for a way out. Whether or not that actually existed, whether or not any of these talks happened and came to either positive conclusion he wanted, or if it was just, once I leave, then I can chase even harder. I don't know, but it must have been a tough place to work if you didn't feel wanted and that you weren't going to go anywhere. And it might have been better for his reputation to be out rather than demoted or, you know, in a sense, he has been replaced, but it's because those talks came out from last year, it sounds like, you know, it was more on his own terms than forced out. So, yeah, I'm not certain he's going there. It does still tally now with Bukowski leaving, but yeah, it's not one where I've been told, yeah, well, that's definitely happening and it's the worst kept secret ever. This isn't like Russell to Mercedes at this point. But I, you know, tomorrow I'm sure they'll put the press release out that he's gone there and I'll look stupid. But, yeah, I don't know that's coming if that's happening.
Yeah, if you could have a word with the press department and say stop releasing stuff on Monday, that would really help our Sunday podcast like a lot. Because we keep having to scramble. We're coming back on a Tuesday to record another show. Let's see. More questions. We've got a couple of minutes left. Are you good? Are you good, Chris?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
cool. Stuart Neal says, please, what chance for Williams? And he puts the begging emoji. What chance for Williams next year?
I think more points than last year. I think further progress. I know they've lost George, but that car was still good. And don't forget, you know, Latifi scored the biggest result first, if that makes sense, before George got the Spa podium that was slash wasn't.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Brilliant qualifying performance. Deserved a podium at the end of the weekend from that, but that wasn't a race. Come on. So how anyone can get trophies and
points
for that, I'm just amazed. But anyway, so I think the progress is actually quite good. I think, you know, they've got solid funding in there. Sounds like they've got a windfall coming from money owed from Rocket after a bit of a lawsuit there for basically saying that they haven't paid us for the title deal that they pulled out of and they have a lot of money. So that sounded like it's been concluded. So that should put them in an even better place. I was told by one team boss that they've heard that Williams will be running at the budget cap this year, which
that's good.
Is good and is achievable now that the level it's at. I think the thing is, for a lot of teams, you know, there's probably six on the grid that weren't running at the budget cap once it came in. But to know where it was, to know what you needed to be at the same level as everyone else, to then try and convince other funders or to get to that level was a lot more attainable. But what was the point in busting your gut to get to that level if others were spending three times as much? It didn't make sense. So now it's just much more realistic for these teams to go for it. So I think Williams can get there. I think the way that they've got Albon in, that, you know, they've got good money out of Red Bull for that, but they've also got a very good driver. And Latifi has improved. I know people will talk about Abu Dhabi, but you know, the points he did pick up when they were on offer.
Yeah.
And there was a few times he got really close to George, even on a Saturday. I think he only beat him once in the end. Was it the final race? He actually outqualified him.
I think you're being very lovely and very generous. And he does seem very nice and lovely as well, which kind of mitigates a little bit. But, you know, he is as good an example of an out-and-out pay driver as you could hope to have. But has he got potential to do a job with Albon is the question.
Yeah, and I'd say yes. I think the progress we've seen from him, he's still not going to be your team leader. And yeah, at this stage of his career, he should be based on how long he's been there. But he will do a solid enough job. His big, big thing he does have to work on is qualifying, because he can't get it hooked up on the first runs. And he's always just missing out that couple of tenths at the end of Q1. George goes through, Latifi misses out, and George keeps improving. I think we saw Latifi once do it. Once he went through, then with that knowledge, he improves a bit again into the next one. He's got enough. Yeah, he's got enough about him that I think he'll do a solid enough job there. Obviously, the money he brings is very, very helpful, which will make the car stronger. That engineering team is very good. Capito is a very good hire for them. So yeah, I'm going to call more points than last year.
Okay, no, call a position. What, come on, what are you doing?
In constructors.
Yeah.
I'll go P7.
Oh, P7. Okay, so one higher.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very tough to work out who's going to move where. And two, I think that would be, you know, some good results will come from that.
That's
I don't
true.
Think we'll see what we had this year where, you know, basically McLaren and Ferrari were locking out the positions behind or even AlphaTauri every now and then, and Alpine when it was on their day. But you had that cluster that were really strong. So for Williams, it was so rare that they could actually get into the points because the midfield was so tightly packed ahead of them. I don't think we'll have that. I think we'll have actually a much bigger spread where at certain tracks, like they could end up being like the fourth quickest team or something, or the third quickest team, and at others they'll be the slowest.
I think William fans after the last 8 years, I think they'll probably take that if there was somewhere they're challenging in and around for the best of the rest. Mr. Chris Medland, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to stick to our allotted time in the hopes that I don't irk you and that you'll come back and visit us in the shed again at some point.
It's not me you need to worry about irking. It's the better half. You know how this works.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. And thank you very much to Jess for her kind permission in that case. But where can people go and find you? Obviously, Chris Medland on the internet. And you do a podcast as well. I suppose we can mention that begrudgingly.
I must say, you guys, you let us mention it last year and listenership went up massively off the back of it.
Like, right, in that case, no.
Steps, so
right.
Thank you very much for everyone who decided to check it out.
Cut the tape, Steve. No, we don't mind.
As long as yours didn't go down.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, one called The Paddock with Lawrence Barreto from F1 and Nate Saunders from ESPN. And it basically starts with a terrible joke from Nate and goes downhill from there. But we do talk F1 sometimes. We talk about like the world travelling around it, things we've done that's a bit weird and cool and fun. And we act like geeks sometimes, you know. It's like, it's the pinch yourself moments of, we got to do this. We got to, you know, play golf with Lando the other day. How cool is that? we do all that sort of stuff that professionally we shouldn't really, but yeah, that's the sort of stuff we talk about. And then yeah, just at Chris Medland F1 on Twitter, and at Chris Medland on my Instagram. And then I write for loads of things. If you Google it, you'll find it, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, look, if you go to Paddock, don't abandon us. That's not how this works. There are two podcasts we ever recommend on Missed Apex, which is yours and For F1's Sake podcast as well, because those guys are a right bunch of turnips. And hopefully that means that you'll be more than happy to come back and join us in the shed again.
Absolutely. And we'll return the favour. I'll make sure that on the next episode that I bitch about how long I was. No, I do talk about how great it was.
The trouble I got into when they let me out of the shed, Chris Medland. Thank you very much. And we will see you. Have a great 2022.
Thank you very much.
And as I abruptly and rudely hang up on Chris Medland, this is the time of the show where during the off season, I'm going to start doing some Meet the Panel segments. So we recorded a bunch before Christmas and we'll continue doing that. And I think it's just a nice little way to end the show because I really do love all the guys on the panel. I respect them. They bring so much professionalism and just slot into the way we do things at Missed Apex, which is, yes, we have been described as pub chat, but we really do try and do stuff the right way. And that means a lot of nagging from me over audio, nagging from Uncle Steve about video as well. And I just love and appreciate the amount of time these guys give up. And over the years, you know, we've gotten to be friends from karting events and hanging out and doing our sim racing stuff too. And I want you guys to get to know these guys a little bit in the way I do as well. So here is, and I've got to make sure I press all the buttons in the right order. Here's our latest Meet the Panel episode. Introducing none other than Matt Two Rumpets. Hello, Matt. Thanks for dropping into the shed for this.
Well, you know, it is such a massive effort for me to set up and join this call. So I'm glad you appreciate the amount of work that I'm putting in here.
Yeah, I know. It can be nervous talking to me over Zoom. You hardly ever do that. No, we do a lot of podcasting together. It's an unlikely pairing in a way, because like we wouldn't naturally in the olden days be suddenly doing a podcast with some random dude from Brooklyn.
Yeah, but weirdly, it makes sense too.
I think it's really helped us with, you know, be a truly transatlantic show. That's what I've really liked about it. A lot of Americans have come on board and gone, because we've got an American voice on there, it gives us like an instant in and relatability, you know. And then you can see how that translates, can't you, to, say, a female podcast or a black podcast where people will go, oh, that person's like me. That's a good start point. I'm now comfy.
Yeah, as they say, representation matters. And it's weird given my general socioeconomic demographic.
Old to be white dude.
Considering that. But in a way, and I went through this watching cycling as well. As an American in a European sport, there is a fair amount of, I'll just use the word condescension because I think that's most appropriate.
Yeah, okay.
Against participants. And so it's been interesting to watch like the progression of the Haas team, for example, the Americans dipping in and out, and just the general vibe that has come from the newer viewers. And to the extent that I offer something, and I like, you know what I really love most? Is I love seeing people saying, I'm brand new. I love being able to learn about the sport. And I feel like regardless of your demographic, kind of what we're trying to offer here is that we are a safe space to learn about this sport and to talk about it at whatever level you are. We're not going to sit here and put on our judgy pants and go, oh my gosh, you don't remember 1993?
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk to you because you're not worthy. I despise that attitude.
So I think we definitely avoid gatekeeping wherever we can. And if we do accidentally do it, I think we tend to identify that. But it is interesting that you were basically a minority, like a novelty, being an American F1 fan. I mean, in 2014, when we started doing stuff together in the F1 space, it was like, oh, how strange, we've got an American. And I always thought having you on a podcast made it sound like we were off the telly. Look, we've got a fancy American voice.
I still to this day am astonished that the funniest thing to me is that were you to come over here with your accent, everyone would be like, oh, it's an authority from... And yet I go over there and everyone's like, oh, you sound like the telly. You must know everything. And I'm like,
stuff.
Yep, sure, you're paying for dinner, right?
I did have that when I went to Manhattan. Everywhere we went, people would stop us and be interested and want to know everything because we had a British accent, sort of slightly pre-internet and social media. But I want to get all personal with you, Matt, because this is getting to know the panel. So the first thing people should know about you is that you are forced to work to my UK-centric timings when it comes to UK stuff. And I'll often go, Matt, jump on the call. And you'll be like, okay. And it's like 5 a.m. But you just go, oh, whatever.
Yeah, you're like, oh, can we do that at like noon? I'm like, well, yeah, it's like 7 in the morning, but okay, sure.
Yeah, I've had to learn time zones because of you. But then when we're doing our evening and we're all settling in, you know, we've got like a rum or something or a glass of wine for the podcast. For you, it's like 2 in the morning, but you'll often join us anyway.
Yeah, well, 2 in the afternoon, but yeah.
Oh, in the afternoon, yeah.
You know, having been to New Orleans, I've discovered that alcohol time can be very flexible. So I just pretend I'm over there and then it's all okay.
Okay, now we're getting into a bit of personal stuff. Why did you say New Orleans? Is that where you're from?
No, it's just one of our, it has been one of our favorite places to go. My wife and I went for an anniversary. We went back later with the kid, did like a family trip there. It's just a fun place to go, but they have a tradition called an eye opener, which is a highly alcoholic drink you consume with breakfast. And that's okay when you're in New Orleans. So technically you can always justify it if you really want to.
Sounds like I could. Sounds like I'd enjoy a trip to New Orleans. Apart from that, what brings you and the wife to go to New Orleans? Was it like an anniversary, a proposal?
Well, she had traveled there for work and really liked it. And then we went back for an anniversary, the two of us. I had actually been in high school, believe it or not. We did a music trip to New Orleans to participate in some kind of competition there. And I remember wandering down the streets with the hurricane multiple times, sort of. I remember I did that. I don't remember actually doing it, if you catch the small difference there.
There's weather in New Orleans?
Yeah, it's hot and tropical there. Oh. Steamy and humid. But the downtown, the French Quarter, is very European in the sense that it's walkable. The architecture is really lovely. And there's loads of amazing food and drink to be found and music everywhere. The music in New Orleans is just amazing.
Ah, because you're a music man. You're a trumpet man, the easiest of all the instruments because it only has three buttons. But you went to like a posh place to learn trumpet. Like when we say trumpet, you're not like a dude that does trumpet as a hobby. You trumpet.
Yeah, yeah. No, I attended Manhattan School of Music for graduate school, and that was...
How long ago?
That was 87 to 89, I think. I was
so
there.
So long ago. I was six.
Yeah, very, very long ago. Yeah. I've forgotten everything I ever learned. But but it was winning that audition to get in, because I had to play in front of the best players in New York who were on faculty there, including legends, international legends on my instrument and other instruments. And being one of the 12 people they admitted that year, that was, you know,
nice.
It's kind of like you go to the Olympics and you have your good moment. And then you're like, well, I might have just peaked right then. That could have been it.
You peaked in 1987.
Yeah. I had one of those. Well, not the only time. I mean, like from a personal point of view, but from an absolutely professional point of view, it's an achievement. It was entirely on merit. And I literally played so far beyond my ability that I still marvel at what I was able to do. Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. It was just one of those moments where everything came together perfect.
And so coming out of that school, is that like the music equivalent of like, oh, I'm Oxbridge, you know, or like a Harvard? Is that prestige?
Yeah, if you imagine it for like fast food cooks, then yes.
Right, okay.
Because musicians are basically lower than hired help over here.
Oh, are they? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's a similar thing in the UK. Everyone kind of admires them on a ground level. But when it comes to professionality, there is an expectation that you do something you enjoy for a living, therefore somehow it's less valuable or your time is less valuable.
Yeah, I'll put it to you this way. A lot of gigs that I do and used to do, I get paid the same now as I did in 1987.
Yeah. And you know, and my wife finds a similar thing. She goes, I've not put my rates up for like 10 years. And I think people want to play less and less. There's obviously, it's a very competitive field as well. But you've been out there doing orchestras and like trumpet gigs. And I love the kind of event type stuff you do. You know, people will hire you to be in a particular uniform for a thing. And you make the event like kick off and be posh.
Yeah, well, it comes with, I'm going to make a living, but I'm not going to have a full-time job and just playing in an orchestra, which is really about the only full-time playing job you can have. I mean, you can get on Broadway and have shows, but shows open, shows close. They don't last forever. So you sort of have to do all of the things. And I've done everything from, you know, wedding parties at the top of W hotels to parades down empty streets in Queens.
Yeah.
It all pays cash, so, you know, me and my trumpet will show up.
Okay, so let's take cash out of it, because I get the feeling that you would be out trumpeting, doing stuff, even if we took away the money factor. So we're not going to make you a millionaire, but we're going to make it that your wage is sorted. What trumpeting are you doing? What music? How are you spending your time?
I would play small jazz. I would do big band and I think chamber music and orchestra.
So it's a selection. I asked my wife the same question. She really struggled to answer it because she just doesn't know that life without having to make the ends meet or doing the music to make the ends meet. So when you give yourself the free rein of where would you perform your art, it's actually quite a difficult question.
Yeah, it is. And I say that, and I'm playing this Friday at the Bitter End with a rock band. And it's one of my favorite gigs just because of the people involved. And I think a lot of, if I could tell you something interesting about music, is that it was and is a very, very social thing. So the gig is fun, but the people are fun. And there always used to be, at least pre-COVID, a lot of times as you get older, it goes away. But you would always do a gig and then you would always go out for drinks afterwards with everybody. And it was always social. And you actually used to go to bars to find work. I mean, you would hang out in the bar. Someone would come in and say, we need people for this. And if you were there and you were free, you took the gig. And that's how back in the day when there was that much work and there wasn't the internet, that's how things happened.
Did you go? I saw a little of that actually in the Manhattan scene, like even just there a week on holiday, Nicola managed to get in like with a group of musicians and do stuff. But did you like carry your little trumpet around in a case?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this predates my time. But yeah, you would everybody could afford to live in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah.
And you would go hang out with the other musicians and they would, you know, And then contractors would come in or people would come in and say, I need a sub. Oh, yeah. Are you free? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who do you know? I know so-and-so. Okay. You know, it was all networks and interpersonal connections that got you work.
And I've seen it in action. And saying it's social, it is. I mean, it's so good at the karting events when obviously my wife's doing the jazz and the piano and the singing, and then suddenly the trumpets breaks out and there's that moment of realization of everyone in the room, because obviously I've just been sitting there going two rumpets for about 6 years, and then that's it, you suddenly get the trumpet out and people go, oh, like I knew, but oh
yeah. Now it's still a surprise to me how much people are impressed by my playing, because it's I'm impressive. Not necessarily all the time. But it's because it's like that sound in your car. You don't notice it because it happens gradually over days and weeks and years. And then someone gets in the car and is like, well, what is that noise? And you're like, oh, that noise. Yeah, I should probably get that checked out. But it's still a treat to me that Jack Nicklaus came up and told me how impressed he was with my playing. I will live with that happily as a compliment.
That is good. And of course, that was at a karting event. So let's talk about you and your relationship with racing a little bit. You are famous on Mist Apex for being very much into the tech and engineering side, which I'll roll back to. But what I was curious really about was you had not done any turning of a wheel until very late in your life. Was that your first competitive go-kart race that you did at Mist Apex?
Yep, absolutely.
At Bunkmore Park, jumping straight into one of the best probably kart tracks in Europe. And straight into those rental carts, which the likes of Brad and that will be like, Sodies, whatever. But for us, we're like, this is too fast and it's downhill and I'm going to die.
Yeah, no, it was plenty fast enough.
Yeah, plenty fast for me.
For me, having I had no prior references whatsoever. It was plenty fast enough for me, and it was quite challenging. And the learning curve is steep if you've never done it before.
No, and the physicality of it as well. They're surprisingly stiff to like go at. And after 45 minutes, a lot of people who don't do it will kind of see their pace kind of gradually drop off. But you were good. You were going around the track pretty well. And I reckon you will end up being in our A final out of three eventually, doing most of those events. But where it's been most impressive has been the sim racing, where in certain classes, just doing sim racing with a desk clamp steering wheel and VR, particularly in the GT cars, you're very impressive, that pace. And considering, you know, as an old sweat, you've picked it up later in life.
Yeah, I think I feel like I have gotten better. I feel like other people have gotten better faster or have gone farther. So I do hit plateaus and I get frustrated at sort of this fixed pace gap. But I try to remind myself that I'm also somewhat limited by my equipment, but the reality is at my age, I'm never going to be able to compete with people that are less than half my age. I the only thing that will save me, and this is why it's kind of been fun to watch the Alonso journey a little bit, is that the only thing that will save me is sort of experience and knowledge and stuff that I can bring from other fields to bear. So I think I've had one pole position once. In all my iRacing career, maybe twice. I've only won, I think, once in F3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, your risk reward as an old sweat does you well.
Exactly. I can bring other things to bear and still be modestly competitive at the level where I currently am. You know, I'm never going to compete with the top guys.
Okay. Okay. And finally,
but I'm learning to live with that sort of, although it does every so often make me want to say I'm absolutely done, because I do have that streak of competitiveness in me.
I know. Me too. And before we go then, finally, be honest, do you just put up with summers because you like having your own little area? Admit it. Finally admit it. Listening to Y2K vortices and tire squirt. It's dull as dishwater, and I think at this point you're just trolling me by putting out the tech times.
Well, you know, I hate to admit it, but I've seen his copy of the notes for our golf podcast.
Is that going ahead?
It's going to happen. I think it's going to happen.
You're going to do a golf podcast?
A tech golf podcast with Summers. No, we have, I mean, kind of like you and I do, there's a weird, we are very different in many ways. there's a weird mentality that we share. And I say weird just because it's weird that we share it, not that it's weird on its own, if you catch my drift.
I'm with you.
But we have a certain simpatico when we do shows, when we do things together. We think the same way about a lot of stuff, and we share a lot of precepts and ideas and approaches. And I think with Summers, it's the same way. But the most inaccessible, most difficult thing has always fascinated. I've always been challenged by that. I always do want to do the hardest thing. And understanding tech at that level is the last thing as a fan you get to. And it's the hardest thing. And there's always more and more to learn. So, yeah, we just, whatever. We share a vibe, to put it in my daughter's terms. And
an energy.
I enjoy it.
Yeah, I do admire it. With me, when it comes to the tech, I get so far into it and I go, oh, that's interesting. And then I hit a point where I think I'm getting diminishing returns. Whereas obviously for you, you feel like you get more returns the deeper you go. And it's very much appreciated by a portion of our audience.
A tiny portion
of our
audience.
No, I didn't say tiny portion.
It's very dedicated.
I said a portion.
No.
Hey, I tell you what, we'll bring this to an end now, Matt. But for a Patreon pod at some point, we should do the Myst Apex origin story at some point in the off season.
Fair enough. I think we can manage it.
Matt Trumpets at MattPT55. Have a happy new year.
Thanks. You do.
Oh, no. If this gets released after New Year, we look like fools. Never mind. Just press the button. And we're back in real time with me in the shed. I was just watching that interview as it rolled back. It was indeed before New Year. And Matt is a very interesting character. As those of you who have tuned into things like Remain Indoors and Doom Scrolling will have realized by now. So you guys might have been wondering where Doom Scrolling has gone. And it is the feeds. We're not doing Doom Scrolling in its old form. But what we're doing is we're bringing Doom Scrolling into our Patreon podcast. So because we have such an active Patreon community now, and because they have basically empowered us to spend more time on Myst Apex, we're going to be doing twice monthly, bi-monthly. Does that work? We'll do two a month. So basically Tuesdays are a day that me and Matt have put aside now for more content. Two of those will be things like Uncle Joe and Matthew Carter and anyone, and maybe Chris Medland, that we can get a hold of for some extra F1 content. But we're also going to have every other Tuesday doing some patron-only content as well. We're looking at some live call-ins. So I've got a bit more call-in experience now. So maybe we'll have a chance to speak to some of our patrons and do a bit of a call-in show and some looser content. So with Doom Scrolling, we will mix in F1 content with also just stuff from our lives and be a bit more relaxed and take on some different topics as well. Obviously, it is in and around F1. We'll just allow ourselves a bit more license to drift, as it were. So if you want to be a patron, please come and support us at patreon.com/MystApex. A fantastic show, I think, with Chris Medland. That was so candid. And the way he was speaking about how he's affected and how things roll and play out to him, not only with the media stuff recently, where the media, the journalists became the focus of Twitter ire, but also, you know, the insights into how the processes work, asking the FIA for information. It was, absolutely fascinating. And I hope we can get Chris on. And do go and check out Ad Hoc. That's not Ad Hoc, Pod Hoc, isn't it? It's his F1 podcast as well. They're great guys. And like I said, during the races, I do have him on tweet alert to make sure that I don't miss anything. So upcoming, we've got some new shows, some topic shows, some discussions, a free reign, because there are no restrictions of those pesky races getting in the way of us making content. Matthew Carter has said early February he's going to come and join us. He's just relocating at the moment, but then he'll be with us. But plenty to look forward to into the off-season. And there really isn't that much time between now and F1 launches and test sessions. So we will be packed, I think. So stick with us here at Myst Apex Podcast. And wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.